Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman. With me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It's great to be here in show number 69. And as we discussed right before the program, its title today is The Mouse That Roars and...
And No Pachem in This Terrace. We're
going to
actually... We're actually going to start out with... I will look at some of the paragraphs of Pachem in Terris, Peace on Earth, and see the vision of John the 23rd, and with that, of course, also Paul the 6th. And we've been talking in the last couple sessions about Ostpolitik, the politics of the East, and the opening up to communism. We've seen already that not everybody agreed with that line of foreign policy, including Karol Wojtyła, who had a very different take. And so in the next couple programs as we go along, we're going to see then a shift in Vatican foreign policy in one direction, and then a shift in another direction, and ultimately the solution to the nuclear nightmare that we've been talking about for several sessions is going to be the demise of communism. And so we'll take a look at that also and see how that that comes about. So of course the mouse that roars is the Vatican itself, the smallest country in the world. But she roars, and her voice is heard again in the 20th century, perhaps more than any time in modern history. And that's important for us to know. And then, of course, then the question of no pachem, no peace in this terrace, in this earth. Okay. And the peace that is constructed in the second half of the 20th century, the reason why there is no world war after World War II is because there's a cold war instead. But the reason why that war was cold and not because it was hot is, quite honestly, because of nuclear weapons. And we lived in a mad world, MAD, mutually assured destruction. And both the Soviet Union and the United States clearly understood that. All the other nuclear powers clearly understood that. And this was something that was assuring us peace, but in doing so was causing us incredible anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, let's take a look then at the center of Pachem in Terris. And these are paragraphs 109, 10, 11, and 12 and 13. And just to read these and to think about these, because what I'm going to do then, after we've looked at this, I want to go back to December 2nd, 1942, and the first nuclear explosion in the world. And guess where it took place? Chicago, Illinois.
No.
Believe it or not. So that's a teaser. So now you got to listen to the rest of this before we get to that. Okay. John the 23rd says this, Pope John says this, he says, "It is with deep sorrow that we note the enormous stocks of armaments that have been and are still being made in the more economically developed countries with a vast outlay of intellectual and economic resources. And so it happens that while the people of these countries are loaded with heavy burdens, other countries, as a result, are deprived of the collaboration they need in order to make economic and social progress." Now, he's saying this just really, once again, months before the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was the most dangerous moment in the history of mankind. And just months before that, he's bemoaning the fact that developed countries are spending incredible amounts of brain power and resources on developing these things, which are not meant to be used, because if they're ever going to be used, it'll mean the death of everyone. Mm-hmm. And he's also talking about there's an opportunity cost to this, and the opportunity cost, the lost opportunity, is the opportunity to use that brain power and the resources in the developed countries in order to collaborate with the developing countries or the undeveloped countries in order to bring them along also for the good of all mankind. So that's an opportunity cost that no one is really thinking about. Then he goes on to say this. He says, the production of arms is allegedly justified on the grounds that in the present-day conditions, peace cannot be preserved without an equal balance of armaments. He's talking about mutually assured destruction without mentioning the word. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't even know if in the early 60s, late 50s, that term was even used yet. Okay, but that's what he's talking about. And so if one country increases its armaments, others feel the need to do the same. And if one country is equipped with nuclear weapons, other countries must produce their own, equally destructive. Well, we certainly found that between the United States and the Soviet Union. But then there's a proliferation that happens very rapidly. The United States shared its nuclear secret with Great Britain. That was part of the deal. There were many British scientists involved with the development of the nuclear weapons in the United States. And so that was part of the deal. So now there are three superpowers. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then China develops the same thing. Now, we've already talked about the love-hate relationship between the Soviet Union and China.
Right.
You know, well, if China has nuclear weapons, she also has a couple potential enemies, too, including in that, of course, India. And India eventually will develop its own nuclear weapon. Now, if India develops a nuclear weapon, there's another country that is a sworn enemy to India, Pakistan. You see, the proliferation. Where does this stop? You know, where does this stop? Yeah. And then France develops its own nuclear weapon, and the French have been incredibly independent of the two-power relationship. They pride themselves on that. And at the same time, because it's very expensive to develop these things, France has fallen to its lower spirit of selling this technology to third world countries that have lots of money, like oil money. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Iraq here, uh-huh. In order to do its own program. This is a proliferation that is downright dangerous. So anyway, this is, you can see the Pope is driving from. We haven't even said anything about Israel. And if Israel develops, and everyone concedes now that Israel does have a nuclear bomb, doesn't that, all of its unfriendly neighbors are threatened by that also. Mm-hmm. So this thing is a very, very, very serious. If we think that the Cuban Missile Crisis was serious, that's nothing in comparison. And now I haven't started talking about a terrorist, which steps beyond all of this. You know, the Pope is only dealing with civilized, rational countries here.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, scary.
Yeah.
Well, he goes on then. He says this, consequently, people live in constant fear. Well, they sure do. And, you know, in John the 23rd, it puts his finger on that button. This is before the Cuban Missile Crisis that the Pope is telling us this. People live in constant fear, lest the storm that every moment threatens should break upon them with dreadful violence, and with good reason, for the arms of war are ready at hand. Even though it is difficult to believe that anyone would dare bring upon himself the appalling destruction and sorrow that war would bring in its train, it cannot be denied that the conflagration can be set off by some unexpected and unpremeditated act. Well, there was a movie back in the 60s that talked about this also, the Failsafe.
Oh, right.
Remember?
Right.
And the accidental possibilities. And one must bear in mind that even though the monstrous power of modern weapons acts as a deterrent, okay, conceding that, there is nonetheless reason to fear that a mere continuance of nuclear tests undertaken with war in mind can seriously jeopardize the kinds of life on Earth. Now here he's talking about something that, we eventually will sign an agreement with the Soviets called a Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Mm-hmm. And what that promised was we would not continue open-air testing. It would be done under control circumstances under the Earth. And because every once in a while you've got to test these things to see whether they'll go off and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, you do. And we had been doing this open-air.
my God.
And this was an incredibly destructive thing to do. A little bit later on, I'll speak about one of these experiments that was done, an open-air explosion. The winds shifted in the wrong direction and ended up going over a Hollywood movie set. They were shooting for a Western out in, Nevada or something like that. And this cloud came over them, and it literally rained nuclear dirt on these actors. And now you might say that they died of, you know, many of them died of smoking cigarettes, you know, because they were heavy smokers. But do you know that every one of those actors on that set died of some form of cancer, including John Wayne? He was one of those who was victim of this, yeah. And there had been plenty of studies also. Dr. Linus Pauling, back in the 60s, had done studies. He's the famous guru of vitamin C. He had done studies on strontium 90 and how the experiments that were done in the West blew these clouds of dust over the Midwest and the South throughout the United States, and there was an increased amount of strontium 90 in cow's milk, which of course ended up getting into the food chain, which many of us of that tender age, I was a kid in the 50s,
sure.
God, I think I'm bald today because of that. I demand compensation.
Yeah, right.
But this is what the Pope is talking about. There are other consequences besides war. In other words, we can still have peace, and we're going to suffer because of these weapons. Well, then he goes on. And in this next paragraph, there are a series of shoulds. We tend to think of Pope John XXIII as a roly-poly, happy-go-lucky kind of guy. Here is a fellow now who's taking his index finger and shaking it at the world leaders. Okay, says this: justice, then, right reason, and consideration of human dignity and life urgently demand that the arms race should cease, that stockpiles which exist in various countries should be reduced equally and simultaneously by the parties concerned, that nuclear weapons should be banned, and finally, that all come to an agreement on a fitting program of disarmament, employing mutual and effective controls. Interestingly enough, this will be the agenda that will take place in the late 1980s, but it's not going to be done in the way that the Pope would have envisioned. It's going to take a different Pope with a different foreign policy, united with an American president, I'm speaking of Ronald Reagan, in combination with a Soviet premier, Mikhail Gorbachev, who the three of these human beings are actually going to do the very agenda of Pachamentaris. But it's going to be done in very different kind of circumstances. Now, the Pope goes on, he says, in the words of Pius the 12th, our predecessor of happy memory, and he quotes here, the calamity of a world war with the economic and social ruin and the moral excesses and disillusion that accompany it must not be permitted to envelop the human race for a third time. And then he goes on to speak, and here I think he speaks to the individual and the human heart. And he says this is paragraph 113. And the Pope says, all must realize that there is no hope of putting an end to the building up of armaments, nor of reducing the present stock, nor, still less, and this is the main point, of abolishing them altogether, unless the process is complete and thorough, and unless it, here's key, proceeds from inner conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We can't do this out of fear. We have to do this out of love. Okay? Unless, that is, everyone sincerely cooperates to banish the fear and the constant expectation of war with which men are oppressed. If this is to come about, the fundamental principle on which our present peace depends must be replaced by another, which declares that the true and solid peace of nations consists not in equality of arms, but in mutual trust alone. We believe that this can be brought to pass, and we consider that since it concerns a matter not only demanded by right reason, but also eminently desirable in itself, it will prove to be the source of many benefits. Now, you know, I think back, one of the quotable quotes from Ronald Reagan was, trust but verify.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to see. That's how this is going to happen. Trust but verify. And it's the mutual trust and even friendship that develops between these three human beings, Ronald Reagan, John Paul II, and Mikhail Gorbachev, trust but verify, that will lead to the solution of this mad, mad world. So, let's start out with December 2nd, 1942.
Okay.
There was a slight explosion that took place in a lab at the University of Chicago. Underneath the football field, there was a little laboratory that had been set aside for these characters, these abstract physicists. And in that lab, they produced a half watt of electricity.
Okay.
But it was produced by a nuclear explosion. Now, a half watt is so little, you know, I mean, even a light bulb is 60 watts or 100
right.
watts,
something
like that. This is one half watt, and it's done by fission. It's a method of bombarding plutonium. There was a tiny piece of plutonium. It was a half gram
okay.
of plutonium, which is incredibly small, and this had been separated out and then bombarded with a free neutron. A heavy element, and the element is uranium. The element is uranium-235. Okay, and what happened is then that there's this little chain reaction that results in the fission, or the breaking apart of these elements, and with that a release of energy. Now, they had been talking about this for 50 years, 75 years, physicists have been talking about this theoretically, that this would be possible to do. This actually now happens. In fact, going back into 1896, you have the there's a physicist who discovers the that radiation is emitted from uranium. You have the Curies, Marie and Pierre Curie, who also investigate this. By 1932, you've got the creation of a radioactive nucleus as now discovering the existence of neutrons. 1938, there are two German scientists who discover uranium fission, that this could happen, this could be broken. This is in 1938, by the way. Man by the name of Hahn and Strassmann, 1938. Guess who's running Germany? Adolf Hitler.
Oh my gosh!
Oh yeah, that's what everyone was saying. Another important man in all of this, an Italian, Enrico Fermi, and all of these believe now that it's possible to have an incredible burst of energy, release of energy that could come from the use of this material. Now, what happens is that as the war gets underway, Adolf Hitler clamped down in Germany, as the war is getting underway, clamped down on the export of uranium from the Bohemian Mountains. This is one of many sources of uranium. But in Bohemia, there were literally mines. And the undeveloped matter, he then refused to allow that to be sent out of the country. At the same time, there were a number of physicists who left Germany, most famous of which is Albert Einstein, of course, for fear of, you know, because he was a Jew. And many of the physicists in the Western world, as they're watching World War II starting to take place. In the United States, we were not at war. This is 1939, 1940, we're not at war. But these physicists are watching what's happening in Germany and their colleagues. And, of course, there's no communication now. And they're fearing the worst. And they're fearing that Adolf Hitler is beginning to develop a nuclear bomb.
Right.
In actuality. The what?
Because he has the store.
Yes, he does. Yes, and he's got, you know, a good number of scientists.
Right.
But in actuality, it would be unlikely for him to develop a bomb because some of the best scientists he had fled from Germany because they were Jewish.
Okay.
And also there is, within Nazism, there is a bias against abstract mathematics.
Okay.
Interesting. I mean, if you look at the endowments at German universities during the Third Reich, if it's in science, the endowments are going to tenure, the academic chairs, all the little perks you get in universities, they're all going to people in biology.
Okay.
And there is a bias toward biology and against physics and mathematics.
Thank the Lord.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I mean.
So, but nonetheless, I mean, there's great fear over this.
Well, yes.
Because we don't know what's going on.
Destruction. But.
That's right. It's only after the war that we understand that his bias was in the direction that saved us from him developing a nuclear bomb. Well, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to the President of the United States. It's a famous letter. It's in all the history books. It's it's one of those that's cited and read. But he writes to Roosevelt, warning him of the possibilities. And with that, you begin having greater resources, pooling of resources. When the United States gets involved in the war itself, there's definite cooperation between the United States, Canada, and Great Britain. Now, Great Britain and Canada had already pooled its efforts to try to develop a nuclear bomb on its own. So there's a real race that's taking place. When the United States gets into the war, everyone recognizes that we've got many, many more resources than anyone else. And so everything is pooled together into this one effort. And so it's then nicknamed, we all know it, as the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first thing that you need is nuclear material. And this stuff just doesn't sit around. In fact, the nuclear material, the uranium-235, they estimated that they would need at least 100 pounds of this in order to make up a – do the nuclear experiments and then actually make up a bomb. Okay, 100 pounds. That's all they need. 100 pounds. In the entire Western arsenal at the time, when the Manhattan Project first got underway, there was 100 millionth of a pound of uranium available.
100
millionth
of
one pound.
And we needed 100 pounds.
So it is going to be a massive project just to pull this stuff together. And as I say, you don't... You don't find this stuff in a mine like you go to a coal mine and pull the stuff out and it might be relatively pure. This stuff has to be mined and then it's developed off of that, and it's all over the place too. I remember a year ago, there was a ship stopped outside of New York Harbor because the Coast Guard had detected nuclear waste on board, or something nuclear on board, and the ship was searched, combed through very carefully. There was nothing there, and so they had concluded that perhaps that there had been something nuclear on board before, and there was some residue. But then they came back with another theory, which is even – and then they tested it and found out it was true. This particular ship was importing into the United States tile, the kind of stuff that you put on your floor, regular tile. And there was a little tiny bit of nuclear residue, uranium residue, in this
tile.
And that's what gave off the alarm.
Oh,
isn't that quite incredible? So, it's all over the place. You just have to, purify
find it and get it in the right form.
Right. And how that happens here in the United States is a plant is established in Tennessee, at Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
And what they do is they take a gaseous compound. I don't want to get into too much science here because I'd get into it's not where I belong. but it's called uranium hexafluoride, and it's a gas. And what happens is that this stuff is then sent through filters, okay, so that it's purified, so the uranium can be taken out of that. And these are massive filters, but Teresa, I mean, the size of this plant So the filtration route that it takes is 70 square miles. The plant itself is 70 square miles. This filter goes around and around. So that's the first thing that's done. And, you know, Oak Ridge is absolutely phenomenal. In fact, it's still being used today. Earlier this year, when Muammar Gaddafi decided to come clean about his own development of weapons of mass destruction, and he turned over to the British and the United States all of his toys, where did they take it? They dismantled all of this in Libya, and they flew it to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And that's where it is today, and it's being analyzed to see how far along he was in developing his own nuclear bomb, which is a scary thought.
Oak Ridge was famous for a musician.
The Oak Ridge Boys. That's right. Yeah. Good group. So that's one thing that's going on. There's another project also going on. This is at the University of Chicago. Which we had talked a little bit about, and they were working on a different element. Rather than uranium, they were working on plutonium. And particularly, they're looking at plutonium-239.
Okay.
The success that little tiny explosion had underneath the field house at the University of Chicago resulted in the construction of another plant. This is out in Pasco, Washington, and this would be to
Pasco.
Pasco.
Okay.
P-A-S-C-O. And this was to develop a reactor out there. With plutonium. This is interesting in itself because what happens in Washington State is a coming together of the scientific community, especially universities, private businesses, and the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so all of these interests are going to come together. We are going to begin developing what ultimately is going to be called a weapons lab. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit about how these things develop. This is the first time, I think, I can't recall, any combination of this since the Roman Empire.
Hmm.
Believe it or not, up around Milan, during the last centuries of the Roman Empire, they had brought together scientists, engineers, and Roman government officials, and they literally did experiments to come up with new kinds of weapons. It was literally a weapons lab, and here we have the same thing developed here. And then, of course, you have another facility that's established too. This is in 1943, and this is under the direction of J. Robert Oppenheimer, and that's going to be the lab at Los Alamos in New Mexico.
Okay.
And again, you have university, private industry, and government all working together. And their project was not so much to get the purified nuclear material, but their project was figure out how to make it blow up. Interestingly enough, the Germans actually were thinking in terms of nuclear power as an alternative energy to oil, because there's no oil in Germany. And since Germany was an industrialized country, it had to run on energy, had to run on oil. And ultimately, the oil that they're going to get is going, for the most part, going to be coming from southern Russia and Romania. And so they were actually thinking in terms of nuclear power as an alternative energy source. The United States was thinking, the Western allies, in terms of an incredibly destructive bomb. And this is the thing that they were going to have to figure out, was how to get this thing to blow up. You know, and so the answer is, as they develop this, is that they're going to put the material inside a casing, and then around the casing they're going to have like shoes. I can't think of anything else, but okay, just think in terms of shoes. And then outside of the shoes there are going to be high explosives,
okay.
And then they're going to implode the nuclear casing, and that's going to push all the nuclear elements together. Mm-hmm. And when they get together, then you're going to have them bumping into each other very rapidly, and that's going to be the explosion that will release the energy. And so anyway, in long and short, that's what they're planning on doing. That's going to be the bomb that's ultimately going to be, that's the style that will be used at Nagasaki.
Okay.
And it's a big round kind of a thing.
Okay.
In...
Now this is what they're doing at Los Alamos?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And in July of 1945, on July 16th, 1945, they actually will test this at a site that's 120 miles south of Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's not only open air, but it's actually on a tower. And they explode this thing at Alamogordo. Okay. There is an incredible light, incredible heat, incredible shockwave that can be felt, seen 10 miles away from the spot. It is the greatest explosion in the history of mankind. It sends a plume of debris up into the atmosphere, 40,000 feet up.
Oh my.
40,000 feet up. Now, I mean, that's a little higher than cruising altitude if you're flying across the country.
Right.
You know, it's that high. And, of course, when it gets that high, that plume then cools. This is incredibly hot stuff. And then when it gets up that high, it cools in the atmosphere, and then it sort of pans out into a mushroom-shaped cloud. That's how you get that telltale cloud that's there. The tower was vaporized when they went to look at this thing. There was no tower there anymore. The desert around the explosion, for 800 yards radius, 800 yards in every direction, the desert sand had been turned to glass. And it was estimated that the explosion itself was the equivalent of setting off 15,000 tons of TNT simultaneously. Now, here's the scary part. See that monitor in front of you, mm-hmm. that computer monitor? That bomb could fit in a box that size today.
Oh, my God.
That's something. The other bomb that was developed also is a slightly different kind of design. It looks like a more traditional kind of a bomb, pretty long, though. Here you have two... ends of a like a vise, and the fissionable material, uranium, now inside that. The other one was plutonium. This is uranium. And there you set off a high explosive that sends the one side of the vise heading down to the other side, and it crushes the uranium in the center. That sets off the explosion. That's what's used in Hiroshima.
Okay.
And there it's believed that was even more powerful. That was the equivalent of 20,000 tons of TNT, or what we would refer to as kilotons. It was a 20-kiloton bomb. Now, to put that in some perspective, one of the most destructive battles of World War I was the Battle of Somme. It went on for months, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of men were killed in that battle. The entire explosive capacity of both sides exploding upon each other in that battle was 10,000 kilotons. So the bomb that was used in Hiroshima was twice as powerful as all the weapons used in the Battle of Somme.
Oh, my gosh.
Just absolutely incredible. It was suggested that that perhaps the best thing to do once the Alamogordo thing took place, which was in July 16th in 1945, that the best thing to do would be to call in a number of international personalities, including high officials of Japan, and give them a free pass to the United States, set off another bomb and say, look, see, that's what we got. Now you want to quit? That suggestion did not make it out of committee.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple reasons for that. One reason was that they weren't sure that a second bomb would go off.
It would work.
You know, what if we brought these people in and it dudded? You know, okay, see what we got here? You know, and it didn't work. That would be disastrous.
Yeah, that wouldn't be so good.
The other thing would be, what if it did work, okay, and they weren't impressed? That's always a possibility, too. And that's even more serious because when somebody asked the next question of, well, by the way, how many of these do we have?
Uh-huh.
The answer was two. We had three, but you just blew one up. So there were only two there.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why they decided to use it on in combat or, mm-hmm. you know, in the war itself. And they chose... Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not the only cities that were chosen, but it was decided to use these and a couple other cities for a couple reasons, one of which was that they were relatively unscathed by the war. They had not been bombed throughout the war. Tokyo had been. Tokyo was leveled, mm-hmm. Firebombed throughout the war. So to set off a nuclear explosion there wouldn't have been nearly as dramatic. But to take a city, particularly a city that was made mainly of wood and paper, the destruction would be much more conclusive. And so on the 6th of August, 1945, and then again on the 9th of August, 1945, Hiroshima and then Nagasaki were leveled. We talked about this several weeks ago, about the diplomacy behind doing this before the Russians had a chance to come in.
Right.
And that didn't work, of course. They declared war on the 8th and all. But nonetheless, this happened. We're zeroing in now on just the destructive nature of these weapons that Pope John the 23rd is trying to convince us to give up. When you look at the casualties of these two cities, there were 68,000 people were killed in these 2 days. 144,000 were casualties. That is to say, they were injured, burned, are killed. This is out of a combined population of 300,000 people. So almost every other person in Hiroshima and Nagasaki okay. were victims of these bombs. 67% of the buildings in Hiroshima were destroyed. 67% destroyed. Others were unlivable beyond that. When you look at the survivors themselves, and they had multiple injuries. 70% of the people who had injuries of the 144,000, 70% of them had burns due to exposure to the pica. And what I mean by that is that when the explosion takes place, there's a burst of light that's referred to as a pica. And since it exploded in the air, there were more people who would have been exposed to that. So within a certain radius of so many miles, if you were outside, whether you were looking at it or not looking at it, it didn't make any difference, and that light could get to you, you would be burned. It was that hot that it would be that it would burn you. There were another 65% were burned by the fires that were set off by this explosion. And then another 30% were exposed to radiation, which was not understood well at the time. And there would be long-term as well as short-term consequences of that. 50% of all of the injuries took place within 1 1/3 miles of ground zero.
1 1/3 miles?
Yeah. So this is very centered, very destructive. Ultimately, they're going to develop two tactics on this. One's going to be a sky burst, and the other will be a ground burst. Mm-hmm. A sky burst will have maximum destruction because it's up in the sky and it's got a larger radius. A ground burst is used particularly, as they come to understand radiation, is going to be used particularly to send up plumes of radioactive dust and then have that stuff flow out and contaminate whole areas. With that. Well, things didn't stop there. After the war was over, by 1950, a jet was developed. Remember, jets had just been developed in the last days of the Second World War. A jet was developed to carry a nuclear weapon. A year before that, in 1949, they figured out how to fit a 280-millimeter howitzer with a nuclear device. This is a cannon. To fire a nuclear bomb from a cannon. You know, the single most important thing there is to make sure you can throw it far enough away that you don't get blown up, too. That's one of the reasons why they abandoned the project of developing a nuclear hand grenade. Yeah. You know, it doesn't make any sense. That is the scary part. And then when you consider the number of these that are even around, even today, we developed from there the 155-millimeter self-propelled howitzer that can fire one of these about 20 miles. But think about all of the shells. Any one of those shells in the hands of a terrorist, and especially a suicidal terrorist, which we've discovered they are, is just a nightmare. It's a nuclear nightmare. In 1951, the United States developed now not just a nuclear bomb, but a hydrogen bomb. The other, we had been talking in terms of kilotons, thousands of tons. Okay, this hydrogen bomb that was blown up in 1951 was between 5 and 7 megatons. They used the Hiroshima bomb as a fuse, as the detonator for this bomb.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, that kind of destruction.
And this is in 1951, so we can see. They fired this off on an island. At least they had enough sense not to do it around anybody. It's the Eniwetok Island out in the Pacific. When they went back to look at the destruction, the island was gone. In 1953, the Soviets explode their own hydrogen bomb. In 1957, the British have theirs. A couple years later, France and People's Republic of China. So now, you know, the nuclear club is out there, and it's pretty darn scary. But the one thing then you rely on is delivery systems, and that's where, I mean, it's one thing to have a nuclear bomb; it's another thing to be able to get it to where you're going. And there, the United States had developed what is referred to as the triad system of, first of all, in the 1950s, very heavy reliance upon the B-52 bomber. To deliver the long-range delivery of these nuclear weapons. And to do that, they're going to have to develop a whole new wing of the military called the Strategic Air Command, okay, or SAC. And then also the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Of course, in the 1950s, that was an embarrassment. We couldn't seem to get a missile up for anything. They were always cracking and breaking up and going off in strange directions and everything. Is only really with the concentration of the Kennedy administration and the project of eventually sending a man to the moon that we really begin pouring the kind of money and effort into the space program that gives us not only space travel but also gives us the exactitude of intercontinental ballistic missiles. But we have to develop better jets, better radar, proximity fuses, anti-ballistic missile systems, all kinds of things develop out of this. Multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, MIRVs. You know, the idea behind that, of course, is that these things, that they're going to be multiple rockets on a rocket. And then when it reaches over the enemy territory, the casing will fall off. and then these rockets that are riding on a platform called a bus will then fire off in many different directions. And so there are multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles. You've got maneuverable reentry vehicles developed in the 1970s, so that not only when the bus clears and the other smaller missiles take off, you're going to be able to actually steer them. Not just pre-recorded. The development in the 70s of smart bombs, of submarine-launched ballistic missiles, all of these things are developed throughout the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. All of these, just as John, or just as John the 23rd is telling us, they up the ante. At every move, they up the ante, and one has to wonder, where do we stop?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, what's motivating all of this is we're not just doing this for the fun to see what we can do. It's the incredible Cold War that's going on, the struggle.
Stay on top.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the whole question of ideology. Which ideology is going to control the world? Is it going to be the West, democracy, capitalism, individual a dignity, human dignity? Is it going to be the East with communism, with a command market economies, where the individual is subservient to the group? How's that going to happen? How's that going to play out? And so you have this competition. As a result of this, both sides are willing to give incredible sacrifice to bring this about. And so certainly here in the United States, taxes are quite high. I mean, the amount of money that's used in the defense programs throughout the 1950s, 60s, 70s is absolutely phenomenal. And then, of course, the 80s, that's a whole other story. We'll wait off on the 80s and how that's done. But it's absolutely phenomenal. And a lot of this is going toward, the engine behind all of this is going to be those weapons labs. They don't call them weapons labs. They call them applied physics labs.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are famous, of course. Los Alamos continues. The University of California is in charge of Los Alamos. MIT gets involved. Caltech gets involved. Johns Hopkins is involved in these labs. And so you have coming together a very interesting combination of government. The federal government is very interested in these developments. Private industry. There are a number of big firms that are involved. And certainly in our own city of St. Louis, McDonnell Douglas was very much involved. They were not just making space capsules for the space program, our commercial jets. They were also very much involved in making high-tech weaponry, and that's just one of, you can name a lot of companies that were involved in this. Universities, some of their finest physicists and engineers and other scientists are going to be on loan to these, and so there's all that combination. And then Congress gets involved in this too, because congressmen want to have these things in their districts. And so congressmen will build their entire reputations on bringing to their district an applied physics lab or one of these big firms that'll be giving lots of jobs.
Right.
And so there's that kind of relationship, symbiotic relationship that develops. The other downside of all of this is that there was a study done in the early 1980s, early to mid-1980s, I believe it was done by the government itself. I don't know which agency, but they believed that this is in 1980s dollars, that the Department of Defense was buying $500 million of junk every year just in order to keep certain companies going in certain districts in order to get the votes of certain representatives for what they really needed and what they really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Wow.
So there's mutual assured destruction. It's actually in the Nixon administration that you get some movement toward limiting this. And particularly in two treaties, the SALT I treaty and the SALT II treaty, strategic arms limitation treaties. And there you have a commitment on the part of the United States and the Soviet Union of doing some limitations. Now, in 1972, just to give you some idea of numbers involved, if both parties abided by their agreements, and the problem here was verification, that's going to be a little problem. The United States would be allowed to keep, in 1972, would be allowed to keep 1,000 Minutemen ICBMs. These are the intercontinental ballistic missiles. They could keep 1,000. The Soviet Union, with their SS-11s and SS-13s, the equivalent of this, were allowed to have 1,095. Now, any one of those could destroy an entire city, a medium to large-sized city. So could you name 1,000 major cities in the United States?
No, I can't.
No. And so there's overkill. But as if that's enough. On top of that, also we were allowed to keep another 54 earlier version missiles called Trident IIs. And then along with that, we also had 656 missiles that were on submarines, okay? And then the Soviets, besides their 1,095, were allowed to keep 211 of a previous missile called the SS-7 and 8, and another 313 of the even later SS-9s, which were heavy missiles, and they were allowed to have 740 submarine launch ballistic missiles.
Okay.
In the end, if you add all of this up, and this is where it gets so absurd.
Yeah.
You know, when you add all of the mega tonnage of each side, the United States had 1,200 megatons. Remember, we destroyed two cities with little kiloton cap guns. This is megatons, 1,200 megatons. And the Soviet Union was allowed through SALT I and II, allowed to have 8,000 megatons. And what can I say?
Yeah, 1,000. 8,000, you say, why the difference? That, what does it matter?
That's right. What does it matter? Yeah, yeah. And what was everything was hinged on was the delivery systems themselves.
Right.
While the Soviets had a preponderance of firepower, they were limited to approximately the equivalent of our delivery.
Of our 1,200.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one has to say, what on earth were we doing to try to counter this? And there is some good news in all of this. We could go ahead and develop the technology of verification. We could develop the technology of defense. Those are the two main things. In other words, we could either get into the Soviet Union and see what they were doing, or we could get into and they would obviously do the same to us. And we did develop that, by the way. We'll talk a little bit about that next time around. And then also the development of defense. The Soviets did develop a missile that supposedly could knock a missile out of the sky.
Okay.
We're going to go a step beyond that with the Strategic Defense Initiative in the 1980s. As I say, we'll talk about that later on, and at least theoretically move in that direction. The only other alternative is to encourage everyone to get very thick doors and to basically build your own
bomb shelter.
Your bomb shelter. Which is really not a very good answer. Mm-hmm. But the good news in all of this is that the United States and the Soviet Union, after the Cuban Missile horror crisis, began making serious steps at making sure that something like this would not happen again. let me real fast and run some of these down. And this all takes place before the strategic arms limitation talks. Okay, come to a treaty. 1963, there's a hotline agreement that the premier of the Soviet Union, the president of the United States, would be able to just pick up a phone and talk immediately. That's very important. There were some communication glitches during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but that would take care of it. That same year, they passed then the Limited Test Ban Treaty that would limit tests only to take place underground. So no more air explosions. Now, the communist Chinese continued doing that, and the French continued doing explosions above ground. I don't believe they've ever signed on to this. They might have since then. I don't recall. In 1967, the Outer Space Treaty, we promised not to put nuclear weapons and missiles and things like that out in outer space. 1967, also the Latin American Nuclear Free Zone Treaty. This is the first time an entire region was declared nuclear free, that they would not put any nuclear weapons in Latin America. There's an exception to that, is Argentina. Argentina already had a rather developed process underway. In 1968, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, promising that we wouldn't give nukes to anybody else. The French did not sign on to that, by the way. We established, through the United Nations, the IAEA, which we've heard so much about the last couple of years, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And they have their work cut out for them. They have a mixed bag. I mean, you know, quite honestly, the IAEA had been sent into Iraq before the Second Iraq War. They reported that there was no nuclear program underway in Iraq. We find out that, in fact, they were correct, only after the invasion. In Libya, they also inspected in Libya and declared that there was no nuclear program in Libya. Muammar Gaddafi voluntarily turned it over to the British and the Americans. So the IAEA has mixed bag there. 1971, the Seabed Arms Control Treaty, that we would not plant nuclear weapons in the sea. In 1972, the SALT I Treaty. And then in 1974, another treaty that limited the amount, the size of nuclear tests to 150 kilotons underground. So what I'm saying here in all of this is there were attempts being made to limit this, both sides spying on each other, using satellites particularly, and the U.S. technology and satellites got to be quite good. And then you have then in the Reagan administration, the Strategic Defense Initiative. So when we come back next time around, we're going to take a look then at this shift in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and ultimately then what will lead to a reduction, the end of the Cold War, and therefore a reduction in that nuclear nightmare. Mm-hmm. Of course, since 2001, we have another nuclear nightmare that keeps us up at nights.
All right. Thank you so much, Father. Shall we close with a prayer?
Yes. Yeah, considering the topic, I guess that's a real good idea. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Yeah.